Mic four, mic three.
Okay, we're ready.
Okay.
Go for it.
Welcome to The Build Guild, a professional, unprofessional podcast for makers.
Professionally unprofessional.
Let's try that again.
You left off the
line. Welcome to The Build Guild podcast.
You didn't write it down, okay. Right?
Welcome to The Build Guild.
He didn't know why.
He
cannot spell worth a crap.
I was writing it quickly on an app.
He's writing it quickly.
He's got a master's.
Totally incorrectly. Ben Myers, MBA. Sorry, continue.
Not in English.
Nothing to do with it.
All right. Welcome to the Build Guild podcast, a professionally unprofessional podcast for makers. I am Scott Foster. I am an excavation contractor. Also known as heavy construction.
Yeah.
And I do my work up in Alaska.
Whoa. So it's been 6 months or so, I think, since we had our last episode.
Yeah.
And we are, if you're watching on YouTube, we're in a totally different place. We're in my new shop. Our last one we did in my new shop, too.
We did.
It was right, but it was about five, 6 months ago.
We're not on the other side like this.
No.
Okay.
But now we're kind of in a round table discussion now that I have the room. As opposed to being all aimed at the same camera.
Mm.
So Scott, we go back really far.
Yep, back in Harding.
Yeah.
Had some mutual friends, played lacrosse.
You're younger than me. You're four years younger than me, but when I started lacrosse, and then I coached, and then you joined up.
Yeah, we never played together, but then coached when I started. I didn't start until my junior year.
Oh, really? Is that late?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how we know each other, and you're coming down to visit, and we thought perfect timing to do a podcast all together.
Yep.
And this, I know it's kind of like we have a podcast for makers, and this is, you aren't so much a maker as a hobby, but you are a doer.
Yeah, a doer.
A doer of machinery, which is pretty cool, and I thought that fit in to making things. I mean, your main thing is making roads, right?
Yeah, roads, foundations for houses or commercial sites, large pads for the oil field industry.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that has to do with moving earth or dirt or rocks. Yeah.
Snow, ice.
We do some snow removal, but we like to take advantage of the winter months when the ground's frozen and not work so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's one thing that allows me to get down here and do something like this.
Right. Cool. So take us back to the beginning where this started. Like, how did... Well, so your company is Foster Construction, and obviously your last name is Foster.
Right.
But take us back to the very inception, I guess. Okay. You may not have existed then.
Right.
But,
I guess the inception would be when my grandpa homesteaded in Alaska after World War II.
Wow.
That's so cool. So they had the Homestead Act, and you get like 160 acres, and it's free if you improve on the land. And a lot of people were improving on the land with, you know, mules and horses. My grandpa had a dozer to improve on his land.
Mm.
So he branched out after building his hay fields or all the stuff you need to do to improve on your land, and was doing it for other people. And then that kind of turned into a couple of dozers and some trucks. And then my grandpa did that up in Alaska. And then he retired when my dad was still in high school. And my grandpa moved to Arkansas, and my dad graduated high school and then went to college at Harding. And then when he moved back to Alaska after getting married, that's when he started Foster Construction initially. And he started it with my Uncle Jack as partners. But back in 2005, they kind of restructured. They both kind of had different plans for the company. My dad wanted to stay small and work with us kids a lot more. And so my Uncle Jack's company was bigger. They got into doing asphalt, and my dad wanted to stay small, stay local, not have to travel around the state.
Is that still Foster Construction, or is that named something else?
They they picked up North Star Paving as their new name, and so for a little bit, Foster Construction didn't exist until my dad and my Uncle Jack split, and then Foster Construction was recreated. It was initially called Foster Construction back in the early 80s when my dad and my uncle partnered.
Yeah.
And then it was SC Foster and Sons on my grandpa's company. But so there's a gap when my grandpa retired before my dad started, and then there's just a a small gap only on paper, really, between when my dad and my uncle split. Mm. That foster construction didn't technically exist, but everybody around town knew the Fosters and that we were an excavation contractor.
So it was what year about that your grandfather decided to homestead on free land in Alaska?
My dad was born in Seward, Alaska in 54.
Okay.
And so they didn't homestead until I think 56 or 58 on the other side of the Kenai Peninsula in the Soldotna area.
Wow.
So if this is the Kenai Peninsula, right? Your thumb?
This is the lower part of Alaska.
Am I thinking correctly?
Or
you show me on your hand?
Your hand does not look like Alaska.
For all the listeners, put your hand out.
Okay.
There you
so
go.
We'll do
this.
This is on my view, so I'll try to switch to the camera. This would be the Aleutian chain.
Yeah.
This would be the panhandle where like Ketchikan Juneau is.
Yeah.
The Kenai Peninsula is kind of right in the south central. I don't know, maybe I can make a little knuckle for the Kenai Peninsula.
Okay.
Cool.
So Seward was on one on the east side of the peninsula, and there's a mountain range that separates it from where my grandpa homesteaded on the west side of the peninsula, and that's where the Kenai Soldotna area, where we do most of our work.
Kenai is most known for like salmon fishing, isn't it?
Yes, the Kenai River is a world-class salmon fishing river. We like to say in Soldotna that we made Kenai famous because the name of the river is the Kenai, but all the sport fishermen come to Soldotna to fish the Kenai River. The Kenai is, or Kenai, the city of, is where the mouth of the Kenai River is.
Yeah.
And so that's where all the commercial fishing is. But if you're doing sport fishing, most of the time you're in the Soldotna area fishing for red salmon or king salmon, silver salmon.
Mm. So this is like the same latitude as the Aleutians.
Yes.
Slightly north.
Okay. Well, the Aleutians take up. It's within the range of the southern part of the Aleutians and the northern part of the Aleutians.
Okay.
Climate's different.
Is it? Because I was going to say, my grandfather was in the Aleutians in that war, and it was cold.
Yeah, cold. It's a lot windier over there.
Yeah.
We do have a mountain range that kind of protects us. And,
okay.
We have a lot more trees than the
cool.
Aleutians. All a lot of the Aleutian islands are really bare.
Too windy
yeah.
for trees.
Yeah. Pete, you kind of have a connection to Alaska. Your brother lives there.
Yeah, he lives in Ketchikan.
Uh-huh.
He's a CPA there. And,
it's very different than making roads, but yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. So my sister-in-law grew up in Ketchikan.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, so their climate is a little more wet than ours, a little bit warmer. We get a little bit more snow, but any weather that we have, they've experienced and vice versa.
Yeah. I think last year they had over 200 inches of rain.
Yeah.
In Ketchikan.
What?
Yeah, it does rain a lot there. We get quite a bit more sunshine on the western part of the peninsula than the panhandle of Alaska.
Okay. So take us into from your dad running things to where you get involved.
Okay, well.
And how would our listeners say, hey, I want to start a business?
Was that your fault or did it happen by accident?
I mean, it was
third generation never had to get a job somewhere else, I think.
Yeah, I've never gotten like a. Well, I have gotten a W-2 from one other place.
What was the other place?
It was in high school. I worked for my girlfriend's dad who had a plumbing business.
Still nepotism.
And that was right around the time when my dad and my uncle split. And so we didn't have a ton of work with the new foster construction. And so I spent some time just digging trenches for plumbers underground, stuff like that.
One thing that I think of when I think of Alaska is a lot of the population does stuff themselves. They have to figure it out. So, like, how does that work with you? I mean, I know you just built a house recently.
Yeah.
I would go back as well in preference. How big is Soldotna? Like, when I picture Soldotna, you know, any Alaskan town, I'm thinking like five igloos and
Well,
and you're taking a sled somewhere to get bread 4 hours away.
No,
so.
I always joke about that, you know, coming to Central Arkansas for school.
Well, down here we're all walking around barefoot and
riding a polar bear and lawnmowers down the road.
Right. Exactly. So that's why I rode a polar bear to school. Living in an igloo. But no, we've got established highways. We're on the road system. You can actually drive to where I am, unlike in Ketchikan. You have to fly there and take a boat.
You have a McDonald's locally.
Yeah, we had a McDonald's, Subway, Dairy Queen.
Oh,
kind of standards.
You're good.
The Kenai Soldotna area, they're only about 8 miles apart, the two towns. They call it the Twin Cities, kind of in reference to Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Yeah.
Obviously, population is much smaller. This Kenai Soldotna and the people who would come from the surrounding area to buy groceries. It's probably about 65,000 people.
Okay. Yeah, that's significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but and it's significantly spread out too. I mean, it's
sure.
You know, that's people driving 45 minutes to get to the area, but there's nothing else within 45 minutes to.
But it's not the way I imagined.
Right, it's not the way most people would imagine imagining Alaska. And people might have a vision of Anchorage, which is an actual city, but it's a lot more spread out than that.
Yeah. So then going to from you jumping into the business.
Yeah, so
it was always expected?
Not necessarily. I mean, it was never pressured on us. It was just always, you know, a job. I started off in the shop with the mechanics, sweeping the floors, cleaning their tools, putting them back, fetching them tools, running on parts.
Yeah.
On our mine sites at our gravel pits, we scale the trucks coming across to know how much weight of gravel. We measure it in tons. So I'd run the scale shack, print off scale tickets to know who to charge how much for the material they're getting, but very minor stuff. I started running equipment, running a Bobcat, throwing the trash cans that were in the shop and running them over to the dumpster and emptying them out.
Like a little skid loader kind of thing?
Yeah, a little skid loader. Yeah. Wheeled the Bobcat. Back then you drove the machine with your arms.
Yeah, yeah.
The levers were on your feet. Sure. I was raising the boom and dumping the bucket.
Now everything's electronic.
Yeah, now everything's way better. You drive the whole thing with your left, and you use the right to lift up, dump, scoop, all that kind of stuff.
I've never driven anything, so it's I've always wanted
one
to.
One of my favorite machines.
Looks cool. Yeah.
It's one of the
mini excavator.
The best to learn on and to get like good foundation on running equipment, and you can actually see the blade you're working with. Lots of stuff we do. You don't actually see like a loader or a dozer. You can't actually see what your blade's doing. You just got to kind of know. And it takes a long time before you get proficient in it.
Go ahead. I would figure like the latest vehicles would have like cameras in the blade or something. Like all cars have backup cameras now. Like everything's
the new equipment does have cameras on the back, but.
We're talking like $5 million for an item or something.
No,
I don't know.
It kind of depends.
What about GPS?
We do have a couple pieces of equipment we have one piece of equipment with GPS, it doesn't use GPS. It uses a Trimble system. And so once you're set up, like this, the newer excavator we have, it's a Hitachi 350. So it's like a 35 ton excavator, big boy.
Wow.
It's a bucket, about 4 cubic yards. So 2.5, 3 scoops, you get a standard 10 yard dump truck full.
Wow.
But on that newer piece of equipment, once you're like level, you can calibrate the machine and it remembers where you are, and you can set like your bucket right where you want it to go, and you can set that as grade, and then it won't let you penetrate that imaginary line.
Cool.
So you can pull a perfectly straight line.
So if you're you're doing a home, it would be perfectly flat no matter what. It will never let you go up and down depending on. Yeah.
Well, you can stay up, but it doesn't let you penetrate. Because sometimes you get a full scoop and you don't want to stay down. You need to pick up so you can not overload the bucket or the machine. And so that's kind of like automatics. And that one also, like we also install water main and sewer main for city utilities and storm drain. And so those all need to be the water line doesn't, but the sewer and the storm drain need to be at a certain pitch. And so that new machine, we can set it, here's our grade, and now we're flowing at 1.5%. And then so it knows that imaginary line at 1.5%. It makes it a lot quicker.
How in the world did people do this stuff before, though?
A lot smarter people than me, very sophisticated equipment.
Are we getting dumber as we go on? Well, because we don't have to rely on
a lot of the industry is, fortunately, it goes both ways. But we are just starting to get into those automatic equipment. And so I've already done all the work where you have to do it yourself, and you have a guy on the ground telling you how much, to how high you are, how low you are. I've done leveling pad, flat for like a shop or even like a large parking lot where there's grades for draining water. You got to do it all by hand. There are newer people getting into the industry where they have the GPS and the automatics, and they can cut grade anywhere, but if they were to wing it without a GPS system installed in there, they really wouldn't be very good.
Yeah.
So I was able to get in and learn how to do things, and now I get to take advantage of the GPS. There are people in the industry that look like they're doing great and know how to do everything, but if you take away their GPS, then they might not be any good.
So when you're digging, here in Arkansas, the frost line is 12 inches. So our footings have to go 12 inches deep,
uh-huh.
right? So where are you guys at?
I've seen frost down at 12 feet before.
12
feet? Yeah, that was in the middle of July, which seems kind of ironic. But
July?
It takes the, you know, the frost, when it gets really cold in October, the frost isn't very deep. So as it gets further into winter, the frost goes deeper, and then it starts to warm up. But the frozen ground underneath it, like, say, 8 feet, it doesn't know it's warm up top. It's still sending its cold energy lower. And so the frost, you know, that's the deepest I've ever seen it. And it was an area that was snow plowed. So the snow actually is a pretty good insulator. It keeps the frost from going deep. And it was a place that was in the shade. And it was driven over a lot. So it was very compacted. And those are the things that contributed to that frost getting so deep. But typically, we don't expect frost. I mean, 8 feet is about what we prepare for area that is plowed and in the shade.
What's code? Like, if you're doing a residential footing, how deep do you have to go?
Well, there isn't necessarily a code, but like 4 feet's the minimum you're going to try anywhere.
It's Alaska. They do what they want.
And there's a lot of, like, I built on silty soils, which hold water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you don't normally want to do that because if the silty soils that hold water get cold, they expand, and anything above it, you know, concrete doesn't flex, it just cracks.
Mm.
So if I ever turn the heat off in my house and let it get cold below my foundation, then there's a chance for things to shift. So I just have to keep the heat on in my house, you know, keep it above freezing, but we insulate around it and it shouldn't really be a problem. And I built on a hill that was basically all silt, which is holds moisture. In a lot of, I'd say the majority of building sites, you're able to dig, you know, maybe 3 to 6 feet down, and then you'll get into some soils that actually drain the water out. And so most of our stuff will excavate 4 to 6 feet, and then we'll haul of the soils that hold water, like dirt or topsoil or the silt, we'll excavate that out down to sand or gravel, and then we'll import more sand and gravel and then pour concrete on it. And those places, they can turn the heat off. They don't have to worry about anything because anything that freezes underneath them won't be holding water, so it won't expand in the cold. So that's the majority of construction in my part of Alaska.
That's cool.
We totally skipped over how you jumped in and took over.
Sweeping floors, picking up after the mechanics, and then it's, hey, the dump site is getting full, so go push it off. So that's about the easiest thing you can do, get in a dozer, just push dirt over the edge to make room for more dirt.
Okay.
And when I first start out, you know, it's not very good. It was very up and down, up and down, up and down. Eventually push them off, but then you do that for a couple of days, and you get better at it, and then it'll be, you know, we got a truck driver coming in, he needs a load of gravel, jump in the loader and load them up.
Yeah.
So I would do that.
Mm.
And first, you're really slow, and you're not very good. Your bucket's maybe a third full. Maybe you hit the sideboard on the truck when you're dumping, but
you end up
getting in it and learning. At least that's the way I did it. And then I really started to learn more when Dad was off on his own, because it was just him, a couple employees, and his kids, which was me and my brother and my sisters at the time. That my sisters run all the equipment. They know the loaders, the excavators, the skid steers.
You have three sisters.
Two of them know how to run everything. My oldest sister, she went to college and ended up graduating with the CPA. And that was before my dad and my uncle separated the company. And so she would do like testing on the gravel to get a sieve analysis or densities. So she did stuff in the industry, but she never really ran the equipment. But the two sisters closest to my age, we screen topsoil, and they do everything. It's drive trucks.
So you were doing all this before you went to college?
Yeah.
And then you said, okay, Dad, I'm gone.
Yep. Went to college.
And you didn't know what you wanted to
do. Right. General idea. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed construction. It was a great summer job. I was able to make more than most people in Arkansas, for sure. I could work all summer, and I didn't have to have a job when I went to college. I was able to support myself. My parents helped out and paid for tuition, but I was able to pay living expenses and food and stuff.
Yeah.
So what did you get? What was your degree?
I have a bachelor's in business administration with a concentration in management.
Okay.
So as a part owner,
makes
the management
sense. Yeah.
You know, I probably use some of it, but to be honest, I don't think I'd really be in a different position if I didn't have a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the degree comes into play and helps me in places that I don't recognize, but
It's hard to quantify.
So like Ben.
Much like me.
Scenario.
Yeah. It's hard to quantify how much your business degree is helping right. when you, everything is a business.
Yep.
And what,
Yeah.
So you went to college and every summer you'd go back and work at home.
Yep. And it was, and work.
When was the writing on the wall where it's like, yeah, well, I'm obviously going
to. I think the biggest writing on the wall was after I graduated, I had my degree. I went to the Dallas area just because it has a bigger population density and more work opportunities, and sent out my resume and found some job descriptions I liked, had some people interested in me, and even though the job sounded good, it didn't pay nearly what I could make running equipment in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And so tried that, because I graduated in December, so there's not a lot going on with earth construction.
That's an odd time to graduate. It's not the normal May.
And so I spent those first few months in Dallas looking for something, and I was like, nothing's really great. So then when work started back up in Alaska, I moved back and started doing that, and took some ownership of the company, bought a percentage.
Your older brother was already, he's your partner now.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
back then, was he
doing similar things. He was working for an electrical contractor on an oil field in like Louisiana and Alabama, did it in Colorado, went to California. So we kind of both, by the time, since I'm younger, by the time I graduated and went to work full time and started ownership in the company, that's about the same time that, because he had graduated a few years prior, jumped around, and we both kind of went back home, started to have more of a management position in the company, and started buying up shares and becoming partners.
Yeah.
And so by that point, I mean, you're in. Ownership stake.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty good gig. We work really hard in the summers. It's nice to have some months off in the winters. I like it. It's a good gig. If people want a 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, it's not going to be excavation in Alaska.
No.
Because you got to work 60 or 70 hours a week, but it's just from maybe April you'd start, and then go through October, sometimes November. Mm. Not much going on. December, January, February, March, still frozen. So
I've always heard that the not necessarily the standard of living, but the cost of living
is higher
mm-hmm. in Alaska compared with practically everywhere else.
Yes.
Same for Hawaii. So is that true? Is that why you were able to kind of lured back there and able to support yourself in college compared with Arkansas, especially when you were...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the standard of living is higher, but the average pay is, I'd say, slightly higher than what the standard of living is.
So
I was making a pretty high wage, or a significant high wage, working in Alaska and then coming to Arkansas to spend it. I mean, that's one of the highest earning to one of the cheapest living.
Right.
So that's what was able to make it to where I didn't have to have a job.
Okay. Understandable, since, I mean, I grew up in northwest Arkansas, where... Back in the 90s in Fayetteville, people from all over started figuring out that was a good place to live, mm-hmm. and they could get houses there for a fraction of what they paid for in California or the East Coast or other places, mm-hmm. and it just exploded. So Searcy, Arkansas, even more so. I mean, it's a nice town, but the cost of living here is far lower than a lot of other places.
Right.
I don't understand how you go from Searcy, Arkansas, to somewhere where it's wet, like California. You can't go that way. You're going to live like a dirt poor person. But if you come the other way, you're living like a king.
Unless you had a heck of an internship or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I remember them telling us, I was graphic design. And they said, if you want to be a graphic designer, you need to go to a big city. You need to go to Dallas or New York. And you need to start now. Kill yourself to get that internship that's going to pay off.
Yeah.
And I could never bring myself to care enough. So that did not. And I mean, that's not atypical. No one wanted that enough to make it. I say no one. I'm sure there were some.
Well, you're a true artist and you want to do the art that you want to do.
I should have been a fine artist.
You don't like to be, you don't like to do art that other people want you to do.
No, I don't.
That's harder.
It's harder.
I don't want to do work that other people want me to do either. I want to do.
There you go.
Yeah.
You and your MBA.
I just mean making something on in the laser or whatever.
Exactly.
This is what I want to make. I don't want to make. Yeah.
Yes.
Hmm. So is there any, is this a lifetime?
Oh yeah.
Till I'm done?
Yeah, I'll You're be doing pulling. This until I'm retired.
Or you sell the company? Somebody else buys it from you and you don't have to work?
Not likely. They can't afford it.
That's not the case.
Yeah. No, it gives a good living. I suppose if somebody was interested to buy it, they'd have to pay me enough that I don't have to work anymore, which it's probably not worth that much. So there probably won't be an offer to make me go do something else.
So you're just going
to
work really until you die and they bury you in the permafrost.
No.
Well, why is it not a goal as an owner to work and hire people to do the things you're doing when you start out, and then you just collect the check and make sure that
doing
the work?
I'd still be the owner. I don't think I'd sell.
It's hard when your name is attached to you.
And it is hard to find
your last name
upper
is literally
management to fulfill the role of
No one will care as much as you will.
Really. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Pete, you were in the same situation because you own
Mason.
You still do, right?
Yeah, yeah. So super similar. I had to go back in the summers and work as well, but I got paid $1.50 an hour. That was it.
Yeah. Different.
Well, I got paid more than you, but I did find out when I first started that I was not making minimum wage. And my dad rightly told me, you're my son. I don't have to pay you minimum wage.
That's right.
I was just like, okay.
Yeah, my parents paid for tuition. And so, but that was the deal. I had to work for $1.50 an hour.
Yeah.
Just enough to pay for gas. And
was that like early 2000s, late 90s, or when was that?
Yeah, 2000s, early 2000s.
So well below minimum wage.
Yeah. I think minimum wage on my first job was $5.25. Uh-huh. I think that was it.
That's what I made when I worked at the library as a student worker, which was the best job I've ever had.
One of the crazy things,
because you didn't do anything,
but it was fun.
Now that we all have like our little side gigs, and I look back at our first jobs and how hard we had to work for such little money.
My very first job out of college was at a bank. I made,
how'd it go?
$8 an hour, and I was miserable.
You didn't like that?
I had to wear a tie. Number one, I don't wear a tie.
Number one, I don't wear a tie.
When I can't. Oh, no tie. And when there was no work to do, you sat and waited for work to do.
Which
and
is, your favorite thing
ben
ever.
Ben Meyer does not work.
Ben likes to sit and do nothing.
I need to be handed a problem and say, I don't care if it takes you a minute or an hour.
Yeah.
Fix this problem. And then I fix it in an efficient way.
Mm-hmm.
Or run my route during, exterminating hours or whatever.
Right.
And get home and I'm done. But man, that was for $8 an hour. And now I look at the side gig making twice as much now as passive income and think, good grief, that was crazy. But I think like you worked as brooming out the shop or whatever.
Yeah.
I know that makes you appreciate the job you have later,
right,
for sure. But also the people that you work for or work for you now have more respect to you because you've done every single thing.
Right.
There's some people in past work things that were a boss and they couldn't do the job I was doing under them. And I had zero respect for them to tell me anything because I was like, okay, here, do my job. How can you tell me to do my job when you've never done it? No clue.
That's one thing.
You're disconnected.
Being a, starting from the bottom, now I'm pretty much in the equipment. I don't do a lot of shoveling unless I'm by myself. We have a ground guy that does the shoveling for me. But when it comes time, we dig, a lot of utilities are underground, gas and power and phone lines and stuff. And a lot of the ground guy's job is to dig far enough to where the operator knows, okay, I can safely take this much earth off the ground and not hit the power line. So if I have a new ground guy and he's digging the wrong way across or digging really slow, I jump out, show him how to dig properly, show him how deep to go, to tell him and be able to tell the operator how deep to go, all that kind of stuff.
So I'm at an age in a place in my life where I will never dig another hole. Absolutely not.
Get an excavator.
You just did that, though.
I would love to dig. Huh?
Didn't you dig the tunnel for your drain over there?
Yeah. You're proving me wrong. I did that for Instagram.
Yes, you did, and it performed fantastically. So, in fact, you will dig a hole.
All right, well, I guess for views and money,
there
I'll dig
go.
A hole.
Okay.
But if it's personal, no.
No?
I just did landscaping, and Molly and I were thinking, let's do it ourselves. And then I got a quote and thought, I couldn't dig a hole for this much money, the amount of time. So, and they brought in the little mini excavator and did it all in a day.
Yep, hydraulics are a huge advantage.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I would love to get a mini excavator.
They're a lot of fun.
I'm thinking too small of tools in my shop. Now that I've pretty much got, you know, the core stuff.
On to the big stuff.
I need to get big machinery, I think. If only you could ship used machinery to me in a cost-effective way.
Not really.
That would be amazing. But mini excavator. If I were to buy a machinery, what would you think be like, hey, this should be your first one that you'd use the most? Mini excavator?
I would probably say one of those farm tractors that has got a front end loader and a backhoe in the back.
Yeah.
It's my least favorite piece of equipment because it's never the right tool for the job, but it is a multi-tool and can do just
it's
about
sort anything. Of the right tool for every job.
So yeah. It's a jack of all trade and a master of none
type tool. Like, I despise being in them because I would rather be in a front end loader if I'm using the bucket. I'd rather be in an excavator if I'm using the backhoe.
Yeah.
But if you're going to have something that does them both, it's a great farm piece of equipment. I understand why a lot of people have them. I just don't enjoy them.
You can only afford one and get the one. Yeah.
I like to use the most efficient tool for the job.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, these landscapers had a mini excavator, and that I really, really liked it.
Yeah.
I thought that would be cool. So what do you mainly make? Like, it sounds like roads.
Yeah.
Roadish stuff to me. You also are dealing with private and government.
Yeah, and commercial. On the private side, we might do 6 to 12 house sites, which would include, you know, the driveway into the house site, excavating the house site to prepare it for a building, and then also hardly anybody's close enough to be on city water and sewer in Alaska, so we excavate for the septic system and then also install a water line after a well driller comes in and puts in the well.
Okay.
And then after the concrete work's done, we backfill it. Once the site's pretty much done, we make sure there's drainage, proper drainage everywhere. Maybe we'll come in and put topsoil in so they can grow a nice lawn.
Let's say on an average house, where if you're going to do all of the house prep and then I guess post stuff from other people, what is that costing a customer for a house?
Usually about $30,000. Okay. It wouldn't get below $20,000 on most.
There's got to be like, hey, we're bringing all this equipment. I've got to get like a minimum cost to get out.
$30,000 is good. I mean, if you're not super far from the road, if you don't have an elaborate huge house and a big garage.
Yeah, yeah.
But $30,000 is a good average home, close to the road, normal size septic. It's a good plug number. And that would be if you're in decent soils. My house, we built an area that has a nice view. It's difficult soils to build in, fortunately.
Yeah.
I'm able to take care of that
cheap. Right.
You'd have to pay more for
what's profit on that? Let's say you're charging $30,000. How much is it like really? Mainly time, not time and wear.
10 would be low. 15's probably more like we're looking for profit.
So half, essentially.
Maybe up to 20 on a larger house site.
Yeah.
If it's something on the river where it's a doctor that's got 3-car garage and 6-bedroom with an oversized septic that goes with it.
Your main cost is man hour or wear and tear on the machine?
Definitely wear and tear on the equipment and fuel. Man hours come before fuel. The equipment is the biggest cost. The upkeep of it, the replacement parts.
Do you have a mechanic on hand?
We've always had a mechanic on hand, and just in the last year, we've had 2 mechanics on hand. It looks like we're going to have to keep 2 mechanics. We'd be overwhelmed if we didn't have 2. We probably need like 1 2/3 of a mechanic. So we're looking that we're building a new shop, so we're going to have some extra space. We'll probably look at hiring out our mechanics to fix some other guys' stuff.
Are you buying machines new or used?
Most of ours, buying new is super expensive. You can do it, or we've done it a couple of times because the financing from the dealers are usually really, really advantageous. You know, like
zero down
almost,
for
0%. Yeah. I mean, you got to do maybe 20 down and 0% for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then we pay it off by then. But for our size company, the ideal for a new acquisition would be maybe something between 800 hours and 2,500 hours, just to where this new sticker price is off and you're not getting into high mechanic.
This hour is foreign to me because I'm used to a mile per hour. You know,
how many miles? Like hours on the engine or hours operating.
Yeah. So what's 200,000 miles in a non-Toyota truck is like the end of life for a car. Right. What would that be?
I mean, I guess it varies based on how well it's been taken care of. But a piece of equipment with 10,000 hours is basically at the end. You're going to anticipate 10, quite a bit of mechanic work. And some failures. 10,000 is like it's retired. I think we have a loader that's that old. And it's not worth much to sell, so we'll park it in a pit that doesn't get used very often. If we need some material out of it, we'll load ourselves and that kind of thing.
So is a lot of your overhead like storing the equipment as well in the wintertime?
Not necessarily. It pretty much all stays outside in the cold and gets snowed on. Most of the overhead comes from the office building itself. And then we have, you know, my mom works full-time in the office, and we have an office manager who works full-time as well. And then, I guess that's about...
What's the size? How many employees do you all have?
We got about 12 that stick with us through the winter, and we kind of keep them busy, but they kind of know the deal that they work hard in the summers. So they don't get many hours in the winter, but they're fine with it. And then when we ramp up in the summer, if you don't count hired trucks, which are kind of owner-operators, we'll have
20. So you sub stuff out?
Yeah.
Okay.
And with the owner-operators on the trucks... It's people that we've worked with quite a bit. They know how we run jobs, and they can jump in the loop with our circle, our trucks, and do the circle and work with us well. So if you don't count those, maybe 25 employees on the high end, and maybe 6 hired trucks at the most.
Yeah.
On like a big site work, like we did the site work for the Kenaitse Education Center, which is a school for one of the Indian tribes, and that was a very large site work that we had. About half a dozen hired trucks, as well as 4 of our trucks, and we did the X'd out all the dirt soils for it, imported all sand and gravel.
I'm assuming you have a lot of regulations if you're moving earth. Is this correct?
Maybe less than you would think. It's kind of standard practice where we are, because nobody can attempt to build on dirt unless, I mean, you could do piling, but then you're not really building on the dirt. Your foundation's down in the ground. You're building above the dirt.
Yeah.
Since it's so standard, I guess the regulation is on the where you're extracting the material to import. So on our gravel pits, or what they call the material sites, that's where our regulation comes in.
So you own plots of land that randomly... I don't understand how it works.
Yeah, well...
You have gravel pits.
Right, and so...
How did you know the gravel was there? How do you make the gravel?
Well, you know, you just randomly there, you
do the random holes.
The gravel was made by nature with glaciers and rivers, and washes all the soil that holds moisture. It got washed out because obviously the water grabbed it and washed it away. So it just leaves behind rocks and sand, which is a good foundation.
Well, geology.
Right. And there's... You kind of know the general areas. You want to be relatively close to a river or stream to find the gravel. And you always test a whole site before you buy it to sell material from it. Then you got to permit it, and it's got to get approval through the planning commission and all that kind of stuff. And then once you have a conditional land use permit, you can operate and sell gravel out of it. So that would be the higher regulation to move in dirt. When it comes to doing house sites, they let you do what you want.
In a gravel pit, can you just dig to China? Well, it might not be China, Alaska. What's the other side of the world? You know what I mean? Can you just go? Take it all out.
Like most of the material sites we work out of are owned by my dad as a separate, or my mom and dad as a separate company entity. And Foster Construction.
Okay.
So my brother and I just bought a gravel pit that's also a separate entity from Foster Construction. And in that particular one, we have to stay above the water table by 2 feet. And so, you know, we have, if you do from the top down, we got about 3 feet of overburden to strip off, and then we get to gravel. And then we've got about 12 foot of mineable gravel face. And then 4 feet below that is the start of a water table. And so we have to stay above that.
Okay.
But we did petition to get our conditional land use permit changed to where we can dig into the gravel table. And they approved it. So now we can dig that 4 feet to the water table. And then there's like another 12 feet between the water and where there's still gravel before you get to a hard pan, like clay layer.
Hmm.
And then from that, it's another 40 feet to anything. So there's, once you get to that hard pan clay, you, there's no more usable material. So we'll be able to mine that like 16 feet above water and then 12 feet below water, and we'll mine it. I think we have a 59 acre pit, which basically we're going to mine all of the center, and then the reclamation will, because you export more gravel to job sites usually than you're importing dirt, but you got to import dirt.
Okay, so you're pulling stuff out.
Pulling stuff out in one spot, and you're comes
dumping
back
trash back in.
Like I was saying earlier,
trash land.
We got to go clear the dump site. Well, that'd be an area of the pit where you've already mined out, and that's where you're importing the dirt to reclaim it.
Okay,
and once it's reclaimed, it's only good for like a field or an RV park. You can't really put a foundation in it.
Right.
And then, so our plan is to excavate the center, reclaim the center with, some of it's going to be ponds, some of it's going to be fields, and then have house sites around the perimeter that overlook the series of ponds and fields.
Oh, okay. So you'll make that into like a development.
Yeah.
So you kind of make double your money then.
Well, you take it takes a very long time to do it. It'll probably be something that my kids are selling.
Oh, okay.
The house sites, because it'll be an operating mine site.
Yeah. So mine lasts a long time. I would assume
this one that we bought, since it is so large, being close to 60 acres, it will last a long time.
Huh.
I mean, maybe we'll get really lucky and sell all the gravel in a decade.
Very how unlikely. Much can you pull out and how quickly?
Yeah.
Okay.
But
interesting.
Knowing the average usage of how much gravel is used in the area, it'll probably last more like four decades.
So I watched a lot of... what's the Alaskan show where they're mining for gold?
Yeah.
They're mining for Gold Rush. Are you like, once you get to the gravel, are you having to like sift out the non-gravel, or like when you hit the gravel area, it's all just gravel?
Yeah, all that gravel that they're working with is all stuff that we can build with. So they're moving so many thousands of yards a day trying to get the, I don't know how much. I think a really good pay dirt might have $10 worth of gold in a yard. That would be really good. Well, we sell our gravel for like $6 a yard.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We don't need the gold in it to get the value from it.
Right.
And I did, we do have a wash plant in our pit that separates that. So there's wash sand, and then there's pea gravel, and then there's what we call concrete aggregate, which is rock from like 3/4 to 1 inch. And then there's small sewer rock and large sewer rock. So it separates all the sizes out. And the smallest size is a sand screw that lifts the sand in a wet slurry up and out, and then it goes on a conveyor, it gets stacked. Well, this fall, since the heaviest particles are gonna settle on the bottom of the sand screw, I did pull out that material and I sifted it for some gold. And you can see little specks gold in there, but it's not anything that could be.
Is this making you want to just switch the whole Foster?
No, not at all. I watched those guys on Gold Rush, and they work very, very hard for similar pay. So. And they have more risk, I would say.
More risk, yeah.
But they have more reward, chance of reward.
Oh, too. Yeah, yeah.
Pretty steady.
But is that wash plant look very similar? Semi-similar?
Yeah, it would look similar to somebody who's not in the industry. It would look very similar.
Yeah.
So here's a question. So in Ketchikan, a lot of tourism.
Yep.
You know, so with COVID that happened, they're usually normally will have like 1.5 million tourists every year. You being in, you know, fishing territory, how did that hurt? Did you feel it?
Well, we felt the lack of tourists around. We still had quite a bit of Alaskans coming down. I mean, a lot of people from Anchorage, if they want their fish, are from the valley north Anchorage, they come down and they fish out of the Kenai River and they take their salmon home. So we still had that traffic, but there's definitely less traffic than normal because the tourists were gone, but not many tourists are buying gravel or building sites. So it was kind of an unknown for us. Like, we didn't know where our work was going to come from, how much we were going to have, but it kept coming in, and there's less traffic when you're driving a lot of gravel trucks. It's kind of a nice thing, so it didn't hurt us. Definitely threw in some unknowns, but our way of life really didn't change.
Yeah,
we talked about houses, but then go to commercials.
Yeah,
or government roads.
Yeah, so most of the government, that's easier to talk about. So most of our government stuff would be with the borough or like Department of Natural Resources. We've done a state park at the Kisilov River, which is just south of where we do our normal work, but not far away, so to where we can go home every night. But like with the borough, they have all these public access, and a lot of them are really old, and they're good enough to get through in the summer months, and if they're plowed, they're fine in the winter. But in the springtime, when things start to melt, they get soft, and maybe people get stuck, or if the cars don't get stuck, the maintenance operator and a road grader will get stuck. So we do quite a bit of improvements on the borough roads. And that's usually putting down like a road fabric, which is a really high tensile strength fabric that's like 17 feet wide, so you'll overlap them in the center, and then they roll out long, so it gives a nice foundation to put gravel on. So when we're building roads, we don't really worry about the soils underneath it that expand, because it's just gravel on top. Yeah. It can expand, and the road comes up a couple of tenths or like 3 inches, and it doesn't really affect anything. So that's how most of our roads are built.
Are you just laying the gravel, or do you come back and pave it too? Or is your uncle coming back and paving?
On a road that does get paved with asphalt, they wouldn't just do a fabric overlay. They would dig it out down to something like sand or gravel or hard pan clay or silt, and then build it back up, and then they could pave it. Because most of the roads we build are still gravel roads.
Okay.
Most of Alaskans don't live off of pavement.
Right.
Most of us live off gravel.
Do you put like fly ash down?
No, I have heard about that stuff, and my brother is familiar with it from Colorado and California.
Yeah.
They put that fly ash in the mm-hmm. roads and stuff, but it's just not a byproduct that we have a lot of up in Alaska. Yeah. Probably from the way that they make their cement or whatever.
Would you say percentage-wise roads are paved to not paved? I mean, even in Arkansas,
there's a lot of gravel.
60%. Well,
most of the county roads that I've been on in Arkansas are paved. They maybe don't have a centerline stripe or fog line stripe, but really the only roads in Alaska.
Or chip sealed. Yeah. Even if it's not paved, it's like a chip seal where this rock kind of recycled hardened.
We've done stuff similar. We'll use recycled asphalt, which is just crushed slab asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can put a chip seal on top of that. And some of like the state roads that aren't paved, they'll have something like our recycled asphalt with a chip seal on it. And it's virtually as good as pavement.
Yeah.
But most of the borough roads, any private roads, generally aren't paved at all. So they're just exposed gravel on top.
How does that happen when you're plowing for snow? Wouldn't you just rip
that
apart?
The first time you plow, there's quite a bit of rocks get pushed up in the snowbank. But once the ground freezes, the blade bounces off top of the rocks.
Yeah.
What about like competition? Is there like any native companies that you're in competition with? Or
most of the native corporations that do similar work are larger. Mm. So they might not have the same niche that we do. We are one of the largest excavation contractors that still does like private sites and is able to do like site work big enough for the school like we did mm-hmm. the last 2 years. The native corporations, they do have their excavation stuff, but they don't usually go after anything small, and maybe we'll overlap on what we call big stuff and they would consider little stuff.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to really big contracts like state roads, or like they're doing a highway bypass going around Cooper Landing, which is area road, or well, it's a town that's on the Kenai River, the upper Kenai, and the road kind of follows the river, so it's quite windy. Well, there's this mountain bypass. They're going to do a bunch of rock blasting and take the highway, eliminate most of the curves that follow the river, and just side hill the mountain all the way around the whole town of Cooper Landing. And that's like hundreds of millions of dollars. It's nothing we would consider touching. That would be.
Do you ever get the road blast?
No, we pretty much stay out of that. We have never.
That's a bummer. That sounds like so much fun. We're gonna blow some stuff up today.
So many regulations.
We have to get a whole new division that could handle all the demolition, and
you could start your own YouTube channel just with that.
Just blast.
We really don't have bedrock in our area for a good 50 miles, and then heading towards. Wow. And then when we do get there, it's all a wildlife refuge, so nobody's really building in it.
So would you say, since it's since you're real close to the river, then it's all like you said, silt. So it's like the end of the river, so it's all flat, like
generally flat. I mean, we have a decent amount of hills. Each stream kind of makes, like, I'm up on a hill that valley, I guess, was created by the Slycock Creek, which is not a very big creek, maybe 6 feet wide and 3.5 feet deep or something. It is a salmon spawning stream, but stuff like that contours land to where there's hills, like, you know, a good 60 feet up, you know, and then there's bigger ones, of course, but it's not unusual to have rolling hills in our area. We don't, the mountains are farther away. You can see them, yeah. They're pretty to look at, but the mountains aren't where we're doing our construction. So,
so do you guys have like wells for water, or yeah. do you collect water from somewhere else?
No, we're, since we aren't in bedrock, we're usually able to get down into an aquifer, mm-hmm. whether it be in an unconfined aquifer, like just immediately below the ground, or in a confined aquifer, like I was saying, in our gravel pit. We have, you know, 16 feet of gravel and then 12 feet we can mine, and then we hit this hard pan. Well, most of the wells in that area are below that hard pan, and then most of them are actually an artesian well. So
yeah.
the water pressure down there at about 120 feet is higher, and it, it will actually blow water out the top of the well. So that's they cool. have to cap it.
Sure. Yeah. It's cool. So now that you've lived both in Arkansas uh-huh. and Alaska, what is the hardest thing about living in Alaska? Like, if someone was going to move up to Alaska, what piece of advice?
I feel like
would
most
you?
People would say the, or they would think I would say the cold.
Yeah,
because it is a very big factor. But I think the daylight is the biggest factor.
Oh yes, yeah. Wintertime, yeah. dark.
Yeah, dark. I mean,
what time is it dark up there right now?
It'll get dark about 4 o'clock.
4 p.m.
Yeah, and the sun doesn't come up till after 10.
Oh my goodness.
So I remember. So
remember that the next time you complain yeah. about.
I mean,
Arkansas
it does suck.
Winter.
It's like 5 or 6 in the morning here, and maybe 5 right now. It's, yeah. I think we passed the darkest time of year, and now
it's 21st. So tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. So okay. right now we're at the darkest.
We're at the darkest.
Sun comes. So it's light out at 10:30. It's dark by 4:15. Yeah.
But once
4:20.
Once it gets to like the 22nd, you guys gain probably
start
like
gaining.
5.
Yeah. It
minutes.
Starts at like 5 minutes a day. At the peak, it's like 9 minutes a day. You gain.
Wow.
Once, maybe even
that's,
10 minutes
yeah.
a day of daylight.
That's pretty cool.
And then in the summertime, you.
It never goes down.
Yeah. It doesn't really go down. We're far enough south that it does go down, but it only goes down so far below the horizon, so the sky's still kind of lit up.
Oh,
on,
wow.
on the longest.
Yeah. Days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about Northern Lights? You get a good view uh-huh. of Northern Lights?
Yeah, there's definitely, the farther north you go, the better you see it. But when I was flying down here, leaving out of Anchorage, was looking north, and there's Northern Lights.
We're that's so cool.
Dancing mm-hmm. around out of the airplane window.
And flying from Alaska to here is a how many hour flight?
Well, this time I went to Chicago from Anchorage. That was 5.5 hours. And then from Chicago to Nashville, it was only about an hour and 50 mm-hmm. minutes.
And driving from Alaska to Arkansas to yeah. go to college was how many days?
Well, I never drove down, but I've driven up 3 times, and it's about 70. The fastest I've ever done it was 72 hours of road time. So that's not counting stopping the fuel. Yeah.
When you've talked to me though,
it's like a week of driving.
About, yeah, a week is the standard.
Oh my gosh.
If you're not seeing the sights and you're waking up yeah. and driving and going to sleep, you can do it in 5-6 days.
It's when you talk to me, the drive from
wow.
I don't know where the exit point in Oregon, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there's a spot in Washington that you can cross, the Cassiar Highway.
Washington is north of Oregon.
Sorry, Washington.
A little bit easier of a drive.
I don't
kind
look
of
at that side of the
Oregon is
the
not
States.
On the Canadian border.
Washington.
Yeah, or you can go up through Montana.
Yeah.
Or the Dakotas. Either.
But you were telling me that going through that Canadian, on the Canadian highway there from, is that one? U.S. 1?
There's several ways to get into Canada from the lower 48, but there's only one road that gets into Alaska.
Yeah, there. And it's U.S. 1, is it not?
I don't think so, but it
oh.
could be.
I, whatever I road know, it was,
Canadian
you were
something.
Saying like, yeah, there's like one gas station every X amount of miles,
right.
and if you don't stop there, you're screwed.
Yeah, especially if the next one is closed. You know, they're not open 24
yeah.
hours.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
I've
there's
been,
nothingness.
I've done it before where you know, you fill up at one gas station, you get to the next one, and they're closed. And you know you're not going to make the one after that. So well, I guess this is where we're sleeping tonight until they wake up in the morning.
Really?
Wow.
Then you can fuel up and make it to the one after that.
That's
in
crazy.
The summertime, they keep more hours because there is a lot of RV traffic. And but
yeah,
I've driven it usually in the spring while everything's still frozen. And still
so
cold.
No Tesla's making that drive.
Not at all. Unless they're towing the generator.
They tow the generator.
Exactly.
Well, that's we're going to sum it up kind of with what uh-huh. you've done there because we're almost like 50 minutes in.
Okay.
So we're going to kind of catch up with the rest of us here on what's been going on in our lives for the last few months. Brian, tell us about your making things you're doing in the last several months. Any projects you've been working on? Or?
just this and that on the laser.
Little bits of this and that.
Yeah,
is
little
what
bits
I've seen.
Of this and that. Very incoherent as usual.
We have some awesome swords.
Yes.
For
I did
birthdays.
Do that. That
these
was a project
fantastic.
For Birthday Apocalypse. All my kids have birthdays in November, and my birthday is in November, so they wanted fairy tale esque motifs. So I laser cut a dozen swords. The laser was out of focus. It did not cut all the way through. Took them all home and cut them on the bandsaw again. That was fun. And I did laser cut acrylic fairy wands.
Yeah.
Also, I made those.
You did. We did find out we can cut 3/4 inch.
Oh, absolutely. And that, we cranked
pine.
The Mira 9 through 3/4 inch craft pine from Lowe's, and
that's
I was elated. Yes, in one pass.
It's fantastic.
So we did push the limits of depth of cut on the Mira, and I am very happy to know because I'm going to use
yeah.
that.
And that's with the standard lens and standard air.
That's right. That wasn't even with the, what is
we
it, 4-inch?
We have
four,
a 4-inch
four
lens that should be able to cut through thicker material,
so,
and I have a compressor that should be able to cut through thicker
so,
material.
Holy
so
smokes.
Possibly an inch thick.
I love that machine.
Modifications.
So I've experimented with lots of different things, palette wood, craft wood on the laser. Have I uploaded any of those files to Etsy? I have not. My Etsy shop continues to do on average as it has done before, so I need to pay more attention to that. I've done some paintings in the last few months.
You also
actually,
have a lot of blasters on your Etsy shop.
Just two.
Well,
just,
it seems like you've sold
files.
A decent amount
well,
of
it's,
blasters.
The actual blaster prints are what people buy most of the time, yes, as usual. But I started painting more, and I've been looking at a lot of abstract artists, and I'm getting really inspired. So I've bought a ton of big canvases and paint, and I'm gonna paint some.
Fling paint.
No, it won't. It will be abstract, but I will not be slinging
shapes
paint.
Shapes and circles.
No, I'm not there. No, it won't be like, you know, Kandinsky stuff either, like geometric
yes.
type.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the Parks and Rec episode.
Uh-oh.
Which I don't know if you
I've
guys
seen like
have
three episodes.
Remembered
I'm
enough.
Sorry.
That's too bad. It's one of my favorite shows.
I know. I'll get
where
to
the art. Each department is making their own artwork that symbolizes like the city, and I can't remember his name. The comedian. Well, there's a bunch of comedians.
Aziz. Yeah.
His character, yeah, Tom.
How do I know this and you don't? And it's your favorite show, and I know. Why do I know this?
Tom pays somebody in an art school to make him art, and it's abstract. And he's like, "This is crap. What is this?" And then he takes it home, and he falls in love with the shapes. And he's like, "I just see the shapes," and he starts crying to the shapes. And that's what I imagine.
It's totally what's going to happen. Yes,
we'll have to
bring it in here, and you're going to cry over it.
A YouTube of the shapes
to touch your spirit and soul.
Yes.
Yeah.
So random little things. Anything big on the horizon? Anything you can think of?
I'm gonna cut some foam on the laser as well.
Go fast. I've cut foam and started a fire before.
It's like EVA foam.
Yes, go fast. I've
have
cut
we tried
foam.
That? Have you?
Yeah. Okay. EVA foam cuts great.
Oh, great. But go fast.
Yes.
Okay.
Fast.
Duly noted.
You don't want to melt it. If you linger too long, you'll. Okay. Oh, much like when we were trying to figure out the door, what is it? The door right there on the floor. Floor mat. The doormat.
Welcome mats.
Yeah. The first one cut great,
yeah,
and then I didn't write
set
down the
one
settings.
On fire.
And the next one I was using the same settings, but I forgot about the liner.
Fire.
I made it like finer than a hair, and it was just cutting over itself and causing a fire every
That's
time.
That's the so. Old lines per inch.
Yes. Pete, give us an update on Rowdy Roman.
Yeah, so I'm just like 3D printing. I have sold a lot this year. It's pretty.
You quit your job.
Amazing. I
last
quit my
year,
job.
And
yeah.
no regrets.
No.
Should have done it sooner.
Zero regrets.
You didn't get that tattoo right here?
No regrets.
Yeah, so I guess the big thing like in the back of my mind that comes with a 3D printing is most of my customers are Onefinity. Awesome. Great. You know, but there's, as a business, I wanted to diversify, and it just has come to me through connections that now it looks like I'm getting a contract with a medical device company and 3D printing stuff for them.
Sweet.
So that could be huge.
Yes, it could.
Because from what I understand is they already have like potentially 20,000 patients. So that'd be a ton.
You're gonna need another printer.
You're gonna need another farm.
I know.
To have more printers.
Well, I just added. I'm up to 12 Prusas and one artillery.
Oh my gosh!
And I'm glad it's winter because
is it hot in there?
It is toasty.
A little toasty.
And his shop. Toasty. What is your shop? How big?
15.5 by 11.5
Oh my gosh!
And these things are getting
wall printers.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
It's nuts.
And they're using. They're getting so hot. In yeah. there. It's just cooking the whole room.
I think I could fit, like, as far as amperage, I can fit two more Prusas.
And before then that would set the building on fire.
Well, I have 50 amps going in. And so okay. 50 amps.
I don't know what that means, but it sounds good.
Well, my house is 100 amps. Most houses are 200 amps now.
Yeah, that's so 100 amps.
You have 50% of your house power going to that yes. shed, which is...
If we turned everything on... It would not be good.
Gotcha. You're at that point.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess horizon-wise, you know, as Rowdy Roman continues to grow, is we're going to have to build a garage. And we'll have an upstairs, and I'll have a new shop.
I've been hearing this for a year.
I know. I know.
So mark this down.
Yes. It's got to happen.
A year from now.
If I want to grow, it's got to happen.
December 20th,
2021. It's hard because... I've Pete operated debt-free up to this point. But to build a garage, I would have to go into debt.
Well, here's a question for Scott.
Uh-huh.
You are on the small end of what you're doing. Well, small, relatively, in what you do.
Yeah, we're the,
and you guys say
the
you're
big the, private guys or the small
right.
public contract guys.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go bigger? Like, Pete stuck where he is, kind of. Sort of. If you want to grow, you got to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's, I would say we have room to grow, especially we've got this new shop we're building. But I don't want it to be quickly, you know.
Yeah, stay under 50 employees.
Yeah, I can see us going from our, you know, we've got a good core 12 employees. If we had a good core 25 employees, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
Maybe take us 3-4 years to get there, and then when our peak is maybe 60 employees for the summertime busy season, that'd be great. Not looking to get hundreds of employees like my dad and my Uncle Jack had, but one
point. Well, they had that, but wow.
Yeah, and they were all over the state.
That was very big.
And they were a union contractor, which I don't plan on being union. Not because I don't like unions, but it just brings in
a lot of
people
things.
That you don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is your tip for Pete? Go into debt and buy a shop. So
not all debt is bad.
That's what I've heard.
You got to make sure it pencils out, but
yeah.
You're going to get there quicker by accepting some debt than by not.
And you may be missing out on other things.
It could
because
be opportunity cost missed.
So there's the risk. I mean, that's the risk, though.
Yeah, so. That's with any business is weighing the risk.
And right now, the risk is not worth it for you.
Well, you got to realize I have a wife. She has an opinion, too.
Well, you're asking for the opinion. That's your problem. I just do and say, oh, by the way.
Oh, my God.
Asking for forgiveness is easier.
You don't need to ask for forgiveness. Oh, by the way, this is what I did. No forgiveness asked. My wife will never listen to this, so it doesn't matter. 21 episodes, 0 episodes listened to.
She not listen to any of them?
No, okay. No way. She could care less.
Okay. Yeah.
So medical device, that's kind of
your
deal.
That's the big thing. I'm really happy to diversify.
If that happens, then I guess you'll have a really good reason to.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
mooring and
as
take
far,
that
I've
chance.
Signed a DNA, so
I thought, yeah, I thought it.
NDA,
NDA, NDA,
not a DNA,
not a DNA.
NDA. Take your DNA. I thought it happened though. Or
well,
still like
I think they're
we'll
waiting
buy a batch
on,
and see how it goes. Or
I submitted the quote. I signed the NDA.
Okay.
It's just I think it's possibly waiting till next year.
Okay.
Well, so we're at that
year
stage.
End.
Sounds like
yeah.
you'd have a contract coming up, and with contracts, is
correct.
Less risk and more.
True. That's true. Ooh, Scott.
Yeah.
I think
it's
Scott's
to
feeling
get
you to
out in
yeah.
some debt.
He's like,
contract.
Well, I'm here. I'm
and
gonna plow that.
That's one thing I'm waiting
for
on
you.
Is to see exactly how this pans out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So.
And another thing we need to talk about that finally got revealed this last month was the big Prusa 3D printer.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
You pre-ordered.
I totally pre-ordered that thing.
Yes.
And so when I was looking at it and I see the price tag and I realize you can have 5 print heads and print in 5 different colors if you want.
Or material.
Most, like what I see in 3D printing is the smaller the item, the more you can crank out and the more it's easier to make profit.
That's why you've got how many minis?
Yeah, I have 6 minis and 6 MK3Ss.
You got 6 of each, okay.
So if I'm printing on a larger, on the XL, I can fit a bunch of small stuff on there, and which means less my time switching printers and stuff. But I think I'm going to go with the 5 print heads, and it's totally for fun.
So, Scott, you don't know the cost of anything.
Should I build a garage? I don't know, but I am buying that printer with all the print heads.
That's right.
So, like the normal Prusa, well, you can look right over here. I have the littler one that's orange. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That one's $400. The one on the left, though, that's orange that was printing something.
Yeah.
That's about $800.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And this new one that came out is bigger.
With 5
with
print
different
heads.
Print heads, so you can print.
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to imagine multiple heads going, because most of these print, there's just one print head.
It's one, but then when it changes color, it comes back and it like pops off one head and it moves to the other one and pulls it back out and starts printing.
And okay, so there's still one thing.
Still one moving. Yeah. It can just change on a whim.
Okay, I'm trying to imagine 5 heads moving around.
That would be crazy.
They're going to hit each other.
Yeah. But it's got, so that with 5 heads, it's $3,500.
Wow. Yeah.
So significantly larger investment.
For sure. With one print head, it's $2,500.
Still significantly larger.
Significant.
Yeah.
And what's the size of this XL?
It's still not three, super XL either.
Yeah,
it's 350 by 350 by 350. I think
that's
so
millimeters.
Ender 5
millimeters.
It's smaller. Size. No, it's the same size as that.
Same
my,
size.
My one up there on the very
Ender
top.
Ender 5.
Right. Yeah. So it is bigger, but it is much more expensive. And that Ender 5 is less than $1,000.
But we know the Prusas are dependable. We've used them for a long, long time. Yep. They're making some pretty crazy claims on this one, like no bed leveling. Z adjustment, all automatic and improved. And I'm a little bit skeptical, but I would love for it all to be true. And I guess we're going to find out.
You know, I made the jump to Prusas just because it's the most hands-off machine that I have dealt with.
Agreed.
Time value of money.
And when I started it, I had another job.
Yeah.
So I could only put so much time into it. So I just invested in that. And now all I have to do is carry one type of machine parts or one brand of machine parts.
And you got rid of, I mean, the only other thing that's come close is the FL Sun Deltas, right? And you had several of those, and I still have two of those.
But I never use them.
Okay. And they're good.
Yeah.
We've run those for months with no issues.
You gotta, if you're going to print in like PETG, you got to really ramp up the temperature more than, say, the Prusa.
Right.
So, but once you get all that dialed in, it prints great and fast.
Still not as good as the Prusa. Not quite there.
Yeah, no, not quite there. But what about you, Ben?
Yeah, Ben.
Most recently, literally finished this morning, was redo my dining room table.
Oh, yeah.
That's just for me. But now that we've moved into this new house and it had an overwhelming amount of wood, which isn't so much now because all the wood got painted white, but the floor was wood. And the dining room table was one of the first things I ever made. For real, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was for us, not for anybody else. But I made a lot of mistakes or things I didn't think about when you make stuff. Yeah. So, like, for instance, if you're making a dining room table and you listen to this, like the undersides of tables, I rounded over the top, but I didn't do the underside. And when you're it had 2 benches. So the benches, like when your leg comes up off a bench and it accidentally rubs that corner, like it rips into you. So I rounded over all those.
You rounded over every edge.
I rounded over a lot of edges. But also I bought pre-made legs. I thought, you know, oh no, Ben, you have a lathe. Well, I can't make, I'm not good enough to make four identical lathes. There's no way.
Yeah.
So I bought those and the benches had weren't rounded over. There were points. So when you shove that bench in and inevitably when you have a, you know, kids under 10, you're just going to shove it wherever. That corner goes right into the rounded pine, which is soft. This was the legs I could afford. And they had dents all in them and whatever.
And you made all the rest of it out of oak, right?
Yeah.
So oak into pine.
Oak into pine, yeah. So I changed that up. I rounded over everything. I rounded all the corners. And I painted the apron and legs all white.
Yeah.
And then I stained the top darker. And then now I have the Fuji sprayer.
Yeah.
And thanks to Furniture by Pete for giving me tips about what I should spray because he makes tables all day long. And I used whatever I used last time was a bad clear, and I didn't put it on well, so it was kind of gummy. The more use you did, it got gummier.
Yeah, remember
so like
that.
The kitchen table always becomes like the do yeah. everything on it, and the kids were like working in glitter, so they're like there's glitter in the table and stuff
stuck there and stayed.
So that, I mean, that's one thing that's fresh off my mind because I literally just finished it now, and I had my laser tube die or go bad, so I've learned how to change out my laser tube, that was an interesting thing I was afraid to do, but it was super simple to change. An Eon Laser FaceTime me during the whole thing, showing how to do it. I mean, the customer service is second to none.
Yes,
really. I put that video up on YouTube just to show other people how it was. I still haven't finished the shop series because I just haven't had the time and the desire to really focus on YouTube, and I really need to. I think the Christmas break has been making me think I could just bang these things out. I have them all filmed and everything, but it's just. I just editing is my least favorite thing to do on YouTube. What else have I gotten in here? I got a vacuum former. That's probably a YouTube video that's coming out soon. It's a little teeny. It's back in the corner there. But like, you put in this plastic and you put in if I wanted to make the cell phone, I could do something to the cell phone. I put the cell phone down and it heats up this plastic and I push it down. It sucks. It vacuums all of it out and it forms this plastic.
So you can make like an injection mold.
Size. And then you can go backwards and, you know, put something inside there. I'm thinking that Pete and Brian need to use it for their packaging.
Yes.
Like when he sells a blaster, it's super
professional. Yeah, I need to print one, bring it here, like you said. And
give it a try. Yeah. So that video will probably be coming out sometime in 2022, or we're in 22, because I really want to get more into that, because that's something I haven't really delved into. I thought it was pretty cool. I did order a Prusa, like the minute they came out, so I'll probably get mine before you. I only did one head, not because I didn't want to spend another $1,000, but the more you talk about it, the more I probably will get five heads, do an update. I can't be behind you in technology. That's not allowed.
I just want to print in water-soluble supports.
That's very exciting.
That'd be so cool.
So when you print stuff and it needs a support, usually it's the same material, and you have to like peel it off, and it looks... But they make this water-soluble to where like you take it off and you just drop it in water, and those supports just kind of melt away. Which is, again, time value of money, which is pretty cool. I did get the upgraded Prusa SL1 resin printer. I did the updated thing. I printed one thing, it didn't turn out right, and I haven't touched it. So I debated I just don't make the money like you do. That's not where my money is. I did redo all of my files on Etsy for the wasteboard, like the Myers Witchop wasteboard. Mm-hmm. That was a big one. I sold them all individually, and I didn't do any of the Vectric files, and a lot of people do that. So I finally just said, you know what? I really need to make a mega pack to sell it all in one shot with Vectric and stuff. So I did do that. So if you're listening and you're interested in that, that's all up. New sizes for like, I did it for the Onefinity Journeyman. So like bigger sizes than I had before. So I have done a lot more Etsy stuff. There's a lot more things on Etsy.
Good for you.
Well, that's kind of where what I've been
inspiration.
Doing. Yeah. And this and that. I did come out with like the Cersei Harding in our local town, ornaments. Mm-hmm. I see Brian on the iPad all the time drawing stuff, and I really have a desire to do it yet. I'm
and
not an artist
it,
the way you
but
are.
But you got it done.
But I did get it done. It was more like a focus on like, can I do this thing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I got a picture of these places. I traced them out. I put them in a Lightburn, and then they came out to ornaments, and no one else has anything like that. So
I'm loving Lightburn more and
that
more.
That was cool. Lightburn is getting better and better. There's some cool stuff in the pipeline I can't discuss yet.
You know that much about
but
it.
But I am, yes.
Well,
I am.
All I know is sometimes I'm just struggling in Illustrator to get SVGs optimized to cut on that laser, and then I fight, and Ben walks over and says, oh, look, you can do that in Lightburn in 3 seconds. And it does.
It's really...
And it's awesome.
It's my favorite program.
So, Lightburn. But,
it's controlling more things in the future. I mean, I'll say that and hopefully not get in trouble, but...
Awesome.
I'm excited because it controls some stuff I have.
I appreciate
it. And I've already beta tested it, and it works really well, and I'm super happy, so...
Sweet.
Yeah, cool stuff. So that's basically it for me.
Cool
going on. Yeah, Scott, we can't find you online anywhere like most people No, because you're not online.
Can't find you anywhere but Alaska.
Yeah. You're in Alaska. That's you have the point. No Instagram. You don't look
I
at Facebook.
I haven't been on it in years.
Yeah,
I'm
on Facebook.
It's been deactivated.
So I'd say you can find Scott at all these places, but you can't.
No.
You have to go to Soldotna, Alaska, and hire him to
yes
do some roads.
Yep.
If you happen to be in Alaska, look up Foster Construction if you need construction.
Yeah. Well, I know done. I've sold some Onefinity accessories to Alaska around Anchorage and whatnot.
Well, I could see that being very handy for a place that's very hard to get certain.
Yeah, to make your own tools.
Make your own
supplies.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's probably going to be
self-sufficiency is crazy.
More 3D printing per capita than yeah. most places.
I still cannot believe what I can do in my shop on my own now. Like, mm-hmm. We were checking out my fiber laser
right.
when you first came, shooting your logo on a stuff
right. yeah.
and you asked me how does this work and I don't have an answer. I understand most of the other machines, but we started watching a video that yeah. had a lot
very
of chemistry
technical. Quite long,
didn't really understand it. It's just
followed about half of it.
Yeah. For whatever happened, it was like 20 seconds of it actually working. It's
yeah.
It's just quick. All I know is it's amazing the era we live in.
Yeah.
Yes.
To yeah. be able to do stuff at home the way we're able to do it is pretty cool.
Agreed.
So, well, cool. Thanks for coming to.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
Arkansas
thanks,
from the Lower 48. Thanks yeah. for visiting, joining us in person.
It was a lot of fun.
So, cool. You guys got anything else?
No.
Brian, Pete.
Nope.
No. Good. Merry Christmas.
No. Yes.
Yeah,
Merry
Christmas,
Christmas,
everybody.
This is the Christmas episode.
Yay.
That's right. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll catch y'all later.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.